This is Polyphonic Press, the podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random. Using the patented random album generator, they are given an album to review from a curated list of over 1,000 classic releases, spanning multiple genres. And now onto the show. Here are your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And the album we're going to be listening to is The Water Boys, Fisherman's Blues.
Okay.
I have no idea who the Water Boys are.
I've heard of them, but I don't know. I'm not familiar with them, really.
Okay. Well, this is what it says on allmusic.com. It says, Mike Scott had been pursuing his grandiose big music since he founded the Water Boys, so it came as a shock when he scaled back the group's sound for the Irish and English folk of Fisherman's Blues. Although the arena rock influences have been toned down, Scott's vision is no less sweeping or romantic, making even the simplest songs on Fisherman's Blues feel like epics. Nevertheless, the album is the Water Boys' warmest and most rewarding record, boasting a handful of fine songs, such as And I Bang on the Ear, the ominous We Will Not Be Lovers, Has Anybody Seen Hank, and the title track, as well as a surprisingly successful cover of Van Morrison's breathtaking Sweet Thing. Okay, so the album was released on the 17th of October, 1988. The genre is folk rock, and the label came out on Chrysalis Records, and was produced by Mike Scott, Vinnie Kilduff, Bob Johnston, and John Dundart. And there are 12 songs on the album, and I think it's right around the time when CDs were starting to come. So there's really no side one or side two. There's 13 songs. But I guess what we'll do is we'll listen to the first six songs and then listen to the other seven. And if you're listening along, which we encourage you to do, the album starts off with the title track, and we'll stop after the song Jimmy Hickey's Waltz, and we've linked the album in the show notes so you can get it on your preferred streaming service. So if you're listening along, which we encourage you to do. And so without further ado, here is the title track on Fisherman's Blues, Fisherman's Blues. So here we go. Okay, and ending side one with Jimmy Hickey's Waltz. Yeah, this is a really good album so far. I'm really into this, you know.
Yeah, there's a few things that I really like on this one, but I did think that some of the songs started to drone a little bit. So, but I don't know. Some of the songs coming along here were pretty good. I thought World Party was probably one of the best ones on the song on this. It was pretty good. Jimmy Hickey's Waltz. I mean, that's just a fun little thing. I think that closes the side for the most part.
It definitely doesn't sound like, well, it's kind of the only thing that gives it away to be being recorded in the 80s is there's a little more reverb on the drums than there typically would be, but it's still not even the most reverbed out drums from the era.
No, it's not. It's got a touch a little bit more. The production actually reminds me a little bit of that of like a Crowded House or something like that. So these guys are British, right?
Scottish, actually. Scottish. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, sort of. I found a few facts about the band. We'll sort of get into that when we get to that segment. But yeah, they're from that area for sure. Yeah, I think the one song I actually thought that should go on a little longer was Strange Boat. Like I felt that was a little too short, and I thought it should have gone on. I was kind of expecting it to go on longer, and then I'm looking at the bar and thinking, oh, it's almost over. This should go on for like another minute or two.
I didn't think it was necessarily to a detriment though, but it did seem, I was a little bit surprised when it ended.
Yeah, but I mean, overall, you're right. Some of the songs, like We Will Not Be Lovers, it's a great song, but it does kind of, it drone on a little bit. And I think it could have, I think they could still use the take. And I think all of these songs were recorded like live off the floor in the studio. So they could have still used the take that they recorded, because it's still a good take, but they could have, you know, cut it up a little bit and, you know, edited it together so it doesn't have that huge instrumental section at the end. There's nothing wrong with that instrumental section. Just, you know, could just cut it down a little bit. And sort of the same thing with Sweet Thing. I mean,
yeah, those two songs I thought were a little bit, I mean, I guess they're trying to do like sort of a jammy sort of thing, but a bunch of jammy bastards. Yeah. I sort of get what they were trying to go for, but I just don't know if they necessarily do it as well as some other bands do. Like, for instance, like the Black Crows or the Grateful Dead or something like that, who are known for doing like long jams and stuff like that, but they're a little bit more intricate and things kind of, they go through like movements when they do these jams and something like that, and they create a mood and something like that. I didn't quite get like that kind of mastery from those two songs.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It feels like they're just, they're not taking it anywhere. They're just extending the song, right? They're not really, you know, they're not really like, okay, maybe we could bring it down and have a little quiet part and slow it down a little bit and then build up to something faster. Like, they're not really doing those sort of dynamics, or maybe changing like the key, or maybe changing the rhythm or something. Like, they're just sort of playing. It's really what it is, and it's done in the studio, is a band will play on, and then because they know that how they're going to end the song is they're going to fade it out. The only difference is this: it doesn't fade out.
Because we're fading out. Is he still recording? Still recording.
All right, keep going.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I think the songs are great. Like, there isn't a bad song. It's just, it could use a little editing, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like this album was actually pretty much well received at the time that it came out. I mean, it was like most of the reviews for the album are pretty positive, and this was actually one of the albums that sort of it did pretty well in the UK. It wasn't a huge hit in North America.
I suspected so.
Yeah, it went to like number 13 on the UK charts. And it only reached 76 on the Billboard 200, which is not—it's not terrible, but it's not great.
No, it's actually better than I expected for something that probably didn't make a lot of waves. It's a little bit higher on the—I mean, considering all the different things that came out in '88. So,
yeah, that is true.
So it's a little higher than I expected it to be, but It sounds like something I think that the UK would get into a little bit more than what in North America would get into. I don't know how to really explain it better than that. Because, you know, there's tastes change, you know, when you cross an ocean or something like that. Yeah. It just has that air about it that it would just do better in its home country or home continent, really.
Yeah. And, you know, and having said that, I think, you know, I think if it were to be released today, I don't know about now, but maybe 10 years ago when, I hate the word, but like when the sort of, like the hipster sort of lumberjack kind of,
I know what you mean.
That, yeah, there were some big hits that came out of that sort of,
there was, yeah, I'm thinking of,
like Mumford and Sons and,
well, there's Mumford and Sons, but the band I liked a little bit better was, I think of their name.
There was this guy, Nathaniel Rateliff.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
Yeah, but he had some hits about 10 years ago that I think would probably, this would kind of fit into that sort of vein.
I was thinking more like the Decemberists, but yes.
Oh, the actually, Decemberists, yeah, yeah.
Something along those lines. Yeah, I could see it doing fairly well, you know, in that subgenre, I guess.
Yeah. So, yeah, it might not be like the biggest thing ever, but I think it would be, it would do well. I think it would do well if it were to be released today. And I think it would have like, you know, I think this is sort of a precursor to bands like Wilco. And, you know, sort of like that sort of that and sort of like the mid 90s sort of roots rock kind of stuff after the grunge had sort of happened, like the sort of like Counting Crows and the Wallflowers and that sort of and Blues Traveler and those sort of bands. I can see it sort of this seems like the sort of, I don't know, maybe the precursor to that.
Yeah, a little bit, even though this is like just a little bit before grunge really got big. I mean, grunge was still an underground thing at this point. It existed, but it was not, you know, the real movement until like, what, 91 or something like that?
Yeah, 91 was when, 91, 92 is when Nirvana really exploded.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
But, yeah, like I said, I really would put it in a similar genre as like with, you know, I mentioned them earlier and no, I'm thinking of the time when it actually came out.
Crowded House.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of put them in a similar kind of vein to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that for sure.
Yeah.
I did manage to find a few facts about the album. So this is considered their best album. It was the one that broke through, and the title track became a hit and was used in a handful of films and TV shows. It was used in, let me see. It was used in the TV series Lights Out, in some of the movies. It was used in Good Will Hunting, Waking Ned Divine and Dream with the Fishes. So it was used in a few movies. I think probably the most famous one is Good Will Hunting. And Mike Scott is the main songwriter and he's the lead singer and for the Waterboys. And there's been over 70 members that have come and gone through the band and he's been the main
70.
Yeah. I think it started out as a band, but really it sort of became more like a collective, like there was Mike is sort of the core of the band, but it's sort of like whoever's available at the time, he kind of gets whoever he can, type of thing. There's no kinda real like official
like Swimmers or something like that.
Or Broken Social Scene or something like that. which
so they really were sort of like a precursor to that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I don't know, but I think so. I think they started out as a band, and you know, we're you
of
know,
course
a couple of guys, but I think as time went on, and he just sort of grabbed who he could to get in the band and to record and go on tours, because there's over on this album alone, like there's five different drummers.
Holy crap.
Yeah. Not all playing at the same time, obviously,
no.
On different songs.
Exactly.
So yeah, so it's not really so much a band as it is sort of a collective, sort of a name, and it's Mike's thing, and he gets, you know, different people, whoever is available.
So the other producers of the album, are they other members, or are they actually like other producers that he's working with?
Well, Vinnie Kilduff he's a singer songwriter and also producer, but I don't think he was ever like a member of the band.
Okay, so he's basically another producer
then. Yeah.
So because sometimes, you know, when you named off four different producers at the beginning of the thing, I just assumed that was the band.
Yeah. I did too. Apparently. Honestly, before I started reading, it's like, oh, okay, yeah. There's, you know, this is something else. And the album, so the album consists of a stockpile of songs that Mike had written over the previous 3 years. Like their last album came out in 85 and this is in 88. So there's a bit of a gap between albums. And it only took a few months to record. And actually they recorded so many songs for the album that there was actually another album from the same sessions came out in 2001. So,
okay.
It was sort of a long process, kind of like how Tom Petty did Wildflowers.
Yeah, exactly.
He just recorded it over a two or three year period. And then
some of the songs were used on She's the One soundtrack. Yeah, that's right. But yeah, and a bunch of other stuff didn't come out until decades later.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, he just stockpiled all these songs. He sort of moved I think he moved from one area to another. Like he's had some major life changes, so he was sort of writing songs as he went along. So,
as you do, as a songwriter,
yeah, exactly, yeah,
yeah.
So yeah, those are some of the things that I found some facts that I found on the album. But I guess we'll get into the second side of the album. But before we do that, let's hear from our friends over at the podcast, Can I Pod with Madness? So check that out.
Can I Pod with Madness? What we will be doing is looking through vintage Kerrang and Metal Hammer, all from late 80s.
I remember when someone lent me Somewhere in Time, and by that time I'd heard Marillion and I'd heard Def Leppard and I heard Bon Jovi on the radio, and I thought I knew what heavy metal was. But when this started, I thought, I don't know if I can take this. It was so harsh, it was so metal. I thought, I think this is going to be too much for me. But I persevered, I pushed through.
Yeah.
And I think if you tell most Maiden fans would probably think this has got a soft album because it's got keyboards on it or synth guitars or something. But yeah, for me, it was a shock to the system.
I credit Alice Cooper with introducing me into type of music, because when I heard that, it was like, two friends over. I was like, listen to me, like, obviously this has blown my mind, so it's going to blow your mind too. This is going to be amazing. And played it to them, and then they went, do you like heavy metal? And I was like mortified. And I've never forgotten that, because she'd been like, yes, I fucking like heavy metal, kicked over the tape player and walked out of my own room.
We'll now take a few seconds before we begin side two. Thank you. Here's side two.
All right, ending the album with a sort of a jam sort of loose cover of Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land. Yeah, I mean, I think overall this album is pretty good. Some of the songs, yeah, there's a song that's even longer, and a bang on the ear. It's a great song. Again, it kind of dragged on a little bit for me, but still a pretty good song. But overall, I think the album is pretty solid, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think there's anything to really complain about, except for some of the droning, but that's about it. Yeah, the second half seemed to be a lot more folky.
Yeah, it definitely was.
But there was still some good stuff.
Yeah, and that song, The Stolen Child, that's actually a poem by W.B. Yeats. And they took that poem and put music to it. So the words are done by Yeats, but it's a the music was sort of done by the band. Which is kind of cool that they did that. And I don't know of too many bands that sort of take up a poem. I think it's public domain, so I think it's, you know, there's no, you know, legal ramifications for doing that, but I don't really know of any bands that really do that sort of thing.
I've heard of it done a few times. I'm trying to think of an example that comes to mind. But, well, the only examples I can really come from are like actually friends of mine that, you know, write poems and then sort of write music around them. But yeah, I know it's been done before. I just can't think of it.
It's not that common though. It's not really, no. Yeah, that, on the other thing that I wanted to mention too, is, the cover of Van Morrison's Sweet Thing. He was singing, he sort of added in Blackbird from the Beatles. That was completely improvised, when they were recording. It was not planned at all. So that was a kind of a spontaneous thing. And although that song dragged on, it was kind of cool to hear the spontaneity and sort of the looseness of the live recording. Yeah, I just thought I'd point that out. That was sort of not a planned thing. It would just sort of happened while they were jamming. So, but, yeah, no, I think the album for me, this album, I think the production is pretty, like, it doesn't sound like the 80s, except for, you know, the drums having that reverb on it. And, you know, it there's no synthesizers or anything, you know, like, which was very common in the 80s, even on stuff that would be like this, like, you know, like fretless basses and sort of the jazzy folk stuff that was coming out in the 80s. It sounds, even though it's cool, it has some elements of 80s production. This really doesn't. This is almost a throwback to.
And yeah, I'd imagine for its time, it was very sort of a breath of fresh air for a lot of things like.
Well, yeah, it is a breath of fresh air, I think. And, you know, I think it's something that, look, I think maybe even the same days when it came out, but around the same time, like in late 1988 is when the Traveling Wilburys came out. And so I think that obviously that was more popular. But I think people were sort of hungry for something a little more
rootsy.
A little more rootsy, yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, it was really hard to. The 80s was a time when it was very hard to escape the digital landscape of music, digital instruments and whatnot, because it was just so new and it was, well, in a lot of ways, it was actually foisted upon the musicians. A lot of ways. I mean, some musicians were, you know, open to experimenting with them to begin with, but
well, Yeah, I always thought of like the 80s, like the musicians who wanted to experiment with like the digital stuff, it sounds good because they're actually enjoying making it. The ones that the record company says you have to have a synthesizer, it's like, you can tell they're sort of like not really that into
it. Phoning it in.
Yeah.
No, it's true. And it seems to be a lot of musicians from the 80s, or I mean from the 70s, the 60s and 70s who managed to last into the 80s, their quality drops off in most cases because of the sound that just doesn't fit their overall vibe or sound or anything like that. It's just suddenly just sounds wrong for them. And it was so common. Meanwhile, there's other bands that came out of the very late 70s and into the 80s where they were experimenting with synths and things from the very get-go, and it sounds fresh and invigorating and, you know, it sounds right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
For them.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, the people who are into that, it's like, oh, they're having a great time because they're, you know, they're real into it, but
they know how to work it in with something else. It's not exactly just an extra ingredient that they have to throw in, like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess this might be a difficult task, but what are your three highlights on the album?
Oh, well, I think World Party stands out for me as being one. And I think the other ones I might have to take from the other side. I kind of liked Has Anybody Seen Hank? Anybody Here Seen Hank?
Yeah. Referring to
obviously about
Hank Williams.
Hank Williams,
yeah.
When You Go Away, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, that was a good one, too. That was a pretty good one, too. I think I would probably go with the title track, Fisherman's Blues.
Okay.
Enjoyed that one. I also really did like Strange Boat, even though it was a little too short. I thought it should have gone on. I did enjoy it. I kind of wanted more of it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think I would probably also then go with, When You Go Away. Yeah, I would, those would be my picks.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed those. So that brings us to the question is, would you listen to the album again?
Oh, I'd have to be in a specific mood, but that's actually tough because it's really not at the top of my list for things to listen to. I didn't hate it. It's fairly good, but there's a few things that just, you know, I have a hard time really loving it. So I don't know. I'd have to give it a little bit of time or something like that, maybe.
Yeah, I agree. I think I would probably listen to it again. But you're right. It's something that I would have to definitely be in the right mood for. I don't think it's something that I could just put on like regardless of my mood. I think it would have to be like really in the mood to listen to it. But yeah, I think I would listen to it again for sure. So I guess we'll end the episode there. Thank you so much for listening if you made it this far. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And we would love if you left us a rating and a review. It really helps new listeners find us. And if you want to support the show, you can get these episodes the day before they go live. You can help us out on our Patreon. Go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress. Every little bit helps. And you can also check out the website. Go to polyphonicpress.com for lots more info and updates. And you know, you can get all the episodes that we've done so far over there. And I think that just about does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.